Hunting boots are a critical component of any successful hunt. Whether walking a short distance to your blind or trudging miles through rugged terrain, your feet are carrying the load. Without the right boots, you could give up early and lose out on that trophy just over the ridge. At Midway USA, we make selecting boots for your next hunt easier. With just a few clicks of a mouse, you can decide on what's important, like waterproofing, insulation, size, width, and savings. For just about everything for shooting, hunting, and the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Welcome to DSC's Campfires with Larry Wysoon. The unique blend of hunting, conservation, and the outdoor lifestyle delivered in an entertaining, informative fashion that only a veteran outdoorsman can do. DSC Campfires is brought to you by DSC, the Dallas Safari Club, Conservation, Education, and Hunter Advocacy, Hornady, Accurate, Deadly, Dependable, Trigicon, Brilliant Aiming Solutions, Ruger, Rugged, Reliable Firearms, Burnham Brothers Game Calls, The Callingest Call Made, Double Nickel Taxidermy, where hunting memories are preserved. Now here's your host, Larry Wysoon.
Welcome to the DSC Campfire. Last week, we talked a brief amount of time, thanks to the rain, about some of the things I'm trying to get done on my place. And we talked very briefly about some of the things in terms of planting trees. Now, we're planting seeds, and in some instances, we're digging out some trees in other parts of our property that we have access to neighbors and to friends who are allowing us to dig up some oak trees and persimmon trees, and particularly the little hard, kind of yellowish-looking plum. When I was a kid growing up on the creek that my dad pushed in, we had a bunch of those plum trees, and I think I was probably as big a competitor for those as were the coons and the possums, raccoons, as I mentioned, and foxes, and good gosh, coyotes, no telling what else ate those things when we hit the ground. I know, of course, deer did as well, too. So I want to try to plant a bunch of those, and if nothing else, hopefully down the road somewhere, somebody can make some jelly or some, maybe even some plum wine made from the property that we own. Got a lot of berries on our property as well, too, primarily dewberries, and these are little blackberries that probably would be called that farther north, but down in Texas we call them dewberries, and a little bit different species, and really good to eat, make great jellies, make great jams, and oh my gosh, make great juice as well too. And of course, because of all that, they also make pretty darn good wine. When I was a little kid growing up, I had an uncle who had access to about 20 different 30 to 40 gallon wine barrels, and as a result of that, he seemed to think it was his job to be the family person to do all the wine. He would make wine out of everything from potatoes to the different berries we had, to peaches to plums, and it was always really good and typical of the German wines. It was a very, very sweet wine that he made, but I remember him delivering gallons of it to my mom and dad, and on those days, my granddad had a nice house with a big old gallery, or porch, if you will, that ran all the way around the house, and so whichever way the wind was blowing or whichever way there was shade, people would kind of sit around and drink a little bit of wine on a Sunday afternoon and tell hunting stories and tell stories about when they were growing up. And some of my greatest memories are being able to sit around and just kind of listen to those stories. I regret the fact that we did not have tape recorders back then, which was kind of the going thing at the time, but wish we'd have had the video cameras we have these days and the different ways to which to record voices. Some of those stories will never again be told, and it's such a shame because those folks were really great storytellers. Back then, they didn't have a TV or a computer to sit in front of, so whenever they got together, they kind of sat on the porch, maybe drank a little wine, told stories about all kinds of different things, and Gosh, I wish I could remember some of those, because I remember sitting there just totally in awe and fascinated the stories they told about hunting and the area kind of where I grew up and fishing and how alligators were prevalent in this area at one time. And then I used to listen to one of my great-granddads, who thankfully was alive when I was born, not too very old, but I remember him telling stories about taking his hounds and hunting black bear in the cane breaks of the Colorado River, which was probably only about, maybe 10, 12 miles to the south of the area that we grew up in. People don't realize the number of black bear that were in this country at one time. And during those years, too, they hunted deer, but they hunted deer primarily for food. And with the number of people that were in this area, a lot of times those deer didn't have a whole lot of a choice or a chance either. They didn't survive very long, but those that did grew some pretty darn nice antlers. Remember my dad having a 6-point buck on his wall. A really nice 6x, had brow tines and G2s, and was about 16, 17 inches wide, gnarly looking rascal. And he told me about how he shot it with a double barrel shotgun when he was really still kind of a youngster. Back then, a lot of folks would come out and they'd set up deer camps and squirrel camps. And if you remember not too long ago, my podcast with Luke Clayton, we talked about how people used to come into these areas that we grew up in, and they'd set up these huge camps to hunt squirrels. That was a big deal back then, as well it should be. Squirrel hunting can be so much fun, and they're really good to eat, and the camaraderie that went around during those camps, you can only imagine and really think about some of the stories that might have been told. Because some of those early guys, they probably saw the buffaloes, and they saw, you know, the end of the Civil War, and they saw a country that in Texas that went from where your light was kerosene, if you were very fortunate, with kerosene lanterns, to having electricity, and going from horse and buggy days and horses to having cars. I remember my grandmother telling me that Grandma Wysoon, when she was tiny, she grew up in this area on Cummins Creek, which is not far from where my little place is and where one of my granddads lived. She told me, she said, you know, I remember when we had nothing but horse and buggies. And she said, I was around long enough to where I was when they put the first man on the moon. And unfortunately passed away not very long of that. But think about that, what that lady saw in terms of transportation was on horseback, train if you were fortunate, stage coaches, wagons. But it was all pretty much related to horsepower in one form or fashion. And then came the Model A and the Model T and the modern cars as we had it, and airplanes and all those kind of things, to actually putting a man on the moon. That's a great step of technology when you think about it, over a relatively short period of time and in one person's life. With my little place, as I hope to do in the future, is I really want to kind of bring it back to what it might have been a bunch of years ago. A bunch of years ago, meaning before we really started doing a whole lot in this country as a human species. And I'd love to see some of the plants come back, and hopefully I can have access to some of the grasses that were here then. And we've been doing a little planting of that. We've been doing a little planting, as I mentioned, of also the different brush species. And where possible, too, we've been fertilizing our oak trees, going in those areas like in February, digging a trench around the edge of where the drip line is, meaning where the outer limbs are, and putting a little triple 13. I have a tendency also to fertilize individual trees, as I mentioned, but also individual plants of yaupon, which some people call a yaupon holly. Great deer browse. One of the other really good deer browses, really two good deer browses that we have here that also respond well to fertilization, are American Beauty Berry, which is an absolutely beautiful berried kind of shrub, and then Smilax. Smilax is greenbriar. Then there are various different species of it, but it's a primary browse species of whitetail deer, and if there's a chance, and there almost always is, for them to produce berries, those berries are eaten by a great variety of different songbirds. If you listen in the background, I guess when we had the rain the other day, it kind of turned a lot of these little birds on. I was walking around on the property a while ago, and I remember being here before we really kind of before we started trying to do much in terms of wildlife. And, you know, if you saw a crow, maybe one species of hawk, maybe meadow larks at the right time, some robins on occasion, because this country used to get covered up with robins when I was a little kid, mockingbird, and maybe one or two other birds. There really weren't a whole lot of birds in this country until I really tried to start bringing back the habitat with planting different things that produce seeds, that also produce forage for little bugs and all those kind of things that serve as food for the various different bird species. That's one of the things I hope to do. I mentioned in the last podcast there were wild turkeys here, and yes, there were many, many years ago, as there were black bear. Now, the closest wild turkey populations are probably about, maybe 75, 100 miles from where I live or where I now have my place here. And so I doubt seriously that they'll get back over this way. And problem is, too, we have very, very small land ownership. When I was a kid growing up, if you had 200 acres, you know, you were a pretty good-sized landowner for this area. And these days, if you own 10 or 20 acres, you're considered a pretty good-sized landowner. We've kind of become somewhat of a bedroom community for the great metropolis of Houston, Texas, the sprawling metropolis of Houston, Texas. And I wish in a lot of ways it was like it was when I was a kid, where it was almost, took you almost a day to get into Houston, because you had like 30 miles an hour that you could go, and it was at least 3 hours that way just to get into Houston. And we very seldom went there, to be honest with you. Nobody really wanted to go to Houston except for some of the young people that couldn't make a living out on the properties that they grew up on, and they kind of gravitated to that Houston area, and as did many, 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 many other settlers, if you will. It's kind of the first part of May. Not really kind of the first part of May. It is the first part of May. Our white-tailed deer have a tendency here to start fawning about the first to second week of May, because if you look to see where fawns are born in which months and at which times, they're born during that time so that mother, the doe, has the best opportunity nutritionally to produce a lot of meat. Sorry, to produce a lot of milk. Meat, yeah, because I'm going to try to take that doe probably later on in the hunting season. But they produce a lot of meat if they're on a good nutritional level. And if they're on a good nutritional level, too, those fawns, while they're fetuses, have a tendency to develop to their potential, to a good size, to be a very, very healthy fawn once it passes through the birth canal and kind of drops on the ground and wobbly-legged starts walking away. If you have vegetation on the ground, too, that provides a fair amount of cover in those situations when those fawns are first born, they're not as apt to get eaten by coyotes. Now, we've got a substantial coyote population, and these coyotes here are a little bit on the big side. A lot of this area at one time, many, many years ago, was the home to the red wolf, which probably weighed anywhere from 50 to maybe 60, a really, really big one. I doubt if it weighed much more than that, but they were red wolves, and over the years, the coyotes kind of moved into this country, and I suspect what red wolves are here were kind of integrated and bred with to form a little bit of a hybrid and kind of just got taken over by the coyotes that moved into this area. But occasionally, you'll have a coyote here that, for some reason, the genes are come together just properly aligned kind of thing, and you'll produce a fair size, much bigger than a usual coyote. Coyotes in this country, for the most part, you know, if you took one that weighed 40 pounds or weighed one that weighed that much, that's a really big coyote. Most of them are in that 30, 35, maybe between 35 and 40 pounds at the very most. 2 years ago, on the property adjoining mine, which I lease for hunting and trying to do much the same thing where I can with that property as I'm doing on mine, I was hunting a little creek bottom, and as I walked the edge of this creek bottom, three does, white-tailed does, came charging out of the creek about, maybe 40, 50 yards in front of me, and I thought, well, that's kind of strange, you know, the wind's in my favor and all those kind of things, and I've been very, very quiet moving along, and surely I'm not the one who spooked them, and if I spooked them, why did they come and run the direction that they did? Well, it didn't take long for me to find out, because within moments of those does appearing and running, I saw movement and noticed it was a huge coyote. Well, fortunately, I had a Ruger number one, and Oh, and a 257 Roberts, and I was shooting some Hornady bullets and ammo, and had a Trijicon scope on it that I'd shot a lot, so I was able to track this coyote and get a shot off at him, and got very lucky. And I guess all those many years of training to shoot running game many, many years ago, finally came back to home, and after being told for years while doing television shows we were not allowed to shoot any kind of running animals, I guess all that came back to the proper muscle memory, and I pulled the trigger at the right time and put this coyote down that was chasing three grown white-tailed does. When I walked up to him, and I go, oh, my gracious, this thing's almost as big as a German Shepherd. I thought, this thing is absolutely huge. Surely just can't be just a regular coyote. Well, my brother's in the livestock business, and he, too, had been losing some calves. And a couple of them, we really figured probably the coyotes had taken them down and eaten them. And I kind of wondered maybe if this wasn't one of the culprits. But I was able to drag this coyote back to where I could call it to a... put it on my vehicle and carry it up to my brother's place, and he weighs out a lot of feed. He does some of his own mixture type thing, so his scales have to be pretty darn precise. Put this coyote, and he actually had nothing in his stomach when I put him up there. I found out later when I did a necropsy on him. But this coyote on the scales that pretty darn close weighed 57 pounds. Now, that's a whole lot bigger than most coyotes are. So apparently this is one of those coyotes that red wolves, cross, whatever you want to call it, that kind of bred back to that size of what a red wolf could be. And I noticed he was a little bit more reddish than a regular coyote. But, you know, coyotes, sometimes you see they're anyway from almost white, silver, to, you know, a lot of russet on them, very grizzled, to in parts of the eastern part of Texas, we run into a lot of black coyotes. My brother actually shot a couple of them on a lease up close to Lake Livingston numerous years ago, and they're coal black. They're really pretty. I've seen one or two of them, and I've always hoped that when I was with Gary Robertson somewhere hunting coyotes that, you know, we might be able to call up one of these odd-colored critters. And fortunately, we haven't had a chance to spend a whole lot of time recently in the eastern part of the state where these seem to be more the norm than they find in any other parts of the state of Texas. But it brought home the fact that what I tried to do, and very recently I was up with Gary and with Craig Archer, and we were hunting coyotes up on the Hargrove Ranch below the town of Lubbock, kind of in the, oh my gosh, it's some of the most beautiful habitats you've ever seen. But it's got an area there. That area has both whitetail and mule deer. In the past, I've hunted whitetail, and last year I hunted mule deer, and thankfully the mule deer population is coming on pretty darn strong. But with the number of coyotes and predators that are there, we're trying to reduce that number to where we can increase the deer population a bit. The habitat can support it. Now, if the habitat could not support more deer, then probably I'd say coyotes, bobcats, take whatever share you want, and, you know, we'll look for the rest kind of thing. But so what I'm trying to do here on my property, and as it worked out, my brother and I and what he property he owns and what property I lease, we've got a little bit over 500 acres that we can do something with. And this type of terrain, this type of habitat, although those deer are not going to stay on 500 acres or stay within the boundary, there are going to be a few that do. And so what we're hoping to do over the next 2 or 3 years, including proper hunting, meaning we're not going to take very many deer off of it other than what we feel is necessary to maintain the habitat in the worst of times, we're trying to increase that deer population. And one of the ways we're doing it, with beyond the food aspect of it and the cover aspect of it, is to trying to reduce our coyote population here as well, too. These coyotes have not been called to in a while that I'm aware of, on at least not the properties that I have control over. So this coming week, good Lord willing, there's time available, I'm going to try to spend a little time calling coyotes here on this property and trying to see, too, if I can't get Gary Robertson to lend me one of the new calls that he developed that takes the sounds to ultrasonic. Those calls work where no other calls work, but I'm also, other than that call that Gary has produced, I've never been real big on the electronic calls. I like the aspect of being able to go out there with my mouth-blown call, which is a C3 Burnham long-range caller, mouth call, and call coyotes on my own. And just a little little bit more of a satisfaction of being able to call up a coyote or a critter as wily as a coyote and to take him. And hopefully I can take maybe two or three coyotes out of this immediate area right here. We do have some bobcats, and right now I'm torn because I really like looking at bobcats, and I like seeing their tracks and thinking that they're here. But to be very frank about it, if the mountain lion or cougar were as efficient as taking down game as a bobcat is, I don't know if there'd be a whole lot of critters left in North America right now. That bobcat is unbelievably proficient, particularly when it comes to young fawns or younger deer up to about 6 months of age. And our deer here aren't that really big, and so I've actually found places where there was no doubt, you know, find the bones, you can find the tooth marks and in the skull. And when you measure them, there's no doubt what put them there. It was a bobcat. And so it's one of those things to, you know, do I really want to see a whole lot of bobcats, or do I want to increase my deer population? Bobcats are pretty to look at, and even if I tried to get rid of all of them, I couldn't do it. And even though I've eaten bobcat, and it is very similar to wild pork and is very delicious, I really have no desire to try to produce a whole lot of bobcats that I can take the skin from and also maybe eat. I really like the old white-tailed deer venison a little bit more than I like that cat venison kind of thing. So kind of torn between that, and I'd really kind of like to get your ideas on it. You know, I've told you in the past there's so many ways to get in touch with me. Of course, you can always go to Facebook at Larry Wysoon Outdoors and Instagram at Larry Wysoon Outdoors. And hopefully in the next few days we'll have a DSC Campfire Instagram account as well, too. We're working on that right now. But I'd like to hear your feelings about how you feel about coyotes, how you feel about bobcats, and, you know, the role that they play. They're in an important role, I should say, when it comes to deer management. But they're like anything else. They really need to be kind of controlled to where, if you let them get out of hand, they'll really start knocking down a whole lot of animals. And I like to see a bunch of little jackrabbits and cottontails. We're getting a few of those coming back. We've got a pretty good jackrabbit population, and I kind of like seeing those around. And so maybe by taking some of those predators too, I can bring that population of hares and rabbits back a little bit as well too. But right now, if you're trying to improve the fawn survival rate, or the increase of the fawn survival rate, right now is a really good time to get after those coyotes and bobcats, to hit them right now, because what happens is those little fawns, when they're born, particularly if there's not a lot of vegetation on the ground, can be seen. And even in those instances, there's no doubt that wild hogs become predators on fawns as well too, because it's the nature of that fawn for the first at least couple of weeks to just kind of lay there and not move no matter what's going on. They very seldom jump up and run. And so if they'll do that, I'm telling you, there is no question. Years ago, I think I've told you, I shot 20 hogs that I felt like weighed about 150 pounds or thereabouts and over, and in an area where we were trying to increase the fawn survival rate. And 18 out of those 20 had whitetail fawns in them. So no question that the wild hog can be a predator on white-tailed deer. I suspect the same thing on mule deer, and probably even if they're in antelope country, the same thing there as well too. So I want to get those fawns up to where they have an opportunity. With the vegetation, it hides them. The vegetation provides food for mom and for the fawn as well too. When we do start losing some fawns, it's usually at that time when those fawns are no longer laying still when something approaches, when a predator approaches, when there's that fright and flight sort of thing. I remember a few years ago that we were doing a helicopter survey, and we were up kind of high, and I looked down, and I just happened to see a little white-tailed fawn, and not too far away from it, I saw a coyote. And no doubt this coyote was stalking this little fawn, and I'm sure, you know, if nothing happened, nothing interrupted him, he was probably going to kill and eat this fawn. So we stayed up high a little bit, and when that coyote got within probably about 10, 12 feet of this little fawn, that's when that fawn realized what was going on, and it was right at that stage when they go from laying still, not moving, not doing anything, not blinking an eye, to that fright and flight stage when they take off running. Well, this little fawn took off running, and this coyote's right behind him. And I told the helicopter pilot, I said, get down there, let's see if we can get in between that coyote and that fawn and give that fawn a little bit of a chance. Well, we dropped the helicopter down and maneuvered it around and kind of turned the coyote, you know, different direction from what the fawn was going, and picked back up again. And unfortunately, as soon as we did, this coyote immediately got back right on that trail and followed this little whitetail fawn into a real dense thicket. And no doubt probably that the coyote, once he got him in that thicket, could probably take that fawn down, because the fawn really couldn't run unless he could hide somewhere. And I doubted that he could do that, So we're at that stage where I mentioned here that I really want to start controlling more predators and getting this deer population up a little bit higher than what it is. And it's a good population. We've got a buck-to-doe ratio of about probably one buck to every 2.5 does, which in an open situation really isn't that bad. We're finally getting to a point now where this year, this coming fall, we're probably going to shoot like 4 or 5 does. We'll probably shoot a grand total of 2 bucks off of the property that we take care of, and we'll concentrate on those older bucks. Here with us, what I try to do is we try to pass up the spike bucks, unless my brother's got grandkids that are right at that stage, at 6 to 8 years old and 9 years old, and they're hunting. And if a spike comes by and they're comfortable with taking the shot, by all means, I want them to take the shot, because that's kind of where I started out with the spike. And then they have to shoot a doe as well, too. That's kind of something we've set up. But for the most part, we'll try to put what hunting pressure there is on those bucks that have reached at least 3.5. Now, part of that is, too, that this particular county where we live, where my place is, there is a rule that says you can't legally take a buck that has less than 13 inches of inside spread, nor one less than has 13 inches of spread and 4 points on one side. I got really lucky this past year and took my first buck that I've taken off this property in many, 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 many years, and it was a 4x5, and he had on the 4 side, he had a kicker point, so he had a grand total of 10 points, and he was probably, well, just shy of 14 inches inside. Our ear-tip-to-ear-tip spread on the deer that we have here is about 13 inches. So if that, with the ears forward and erect looking at you, if that inside main beam spread is beyond that, you know, he's probably going to be at least that 13 inches. There were some other bucks that we really were hoping to try to get onto. We've got a couple of ghost bucks whose tracks we see, and I've seen them at night, but we can't seem to see them during daylight hours at all. So I'm sure that happens where you hunt as well, too. Kind of rambled around a little bit this morning talking about some of the things we're doing on my place. And again, I'd love to hear what you're doing on the places that you have, that you manage, that you own, that you hunt, to get some ideas, maybe even cross with some ideas. You know, one of the things I'm really big into is I want to learn as much as I can. And one of the things is I can learn a whole lot more by listening than talking. Now, the only other talk I'm going to do today before we shut this thing down is simply that if you're not a member of DSC, you really need to become a member of the Dallas Safari Club. And we're going more and more by DSC. I think we're going to have a secondary fundraiser this year that's probably going to take place probably in the middle of September. Had so many gracious hunts offered to us for the convention that we had in January, the virtual convention. And a lot of these hunts that we didn't sell or didn't put up for auction at the primary convention, we'll put up for auction, and there'll be a virtual auction, but there also will probably be an in-person auction. Then, too, I want to remind you to not forget about the DSCF Summer Gala that is going to take place June the 12th. It is limited seating, and you can learn more by going to dscf.org, or either that or go to the Dallas Safari Club website, which is biggame.org, and learn more about it. But with both those upcoming auctions, particularly I can tell you a little bit about the one we're having for the DSCF. That's going to be a virtual auction, and it'll also be a live auction at the gala. But there's an antelope hunt on that that auction agenda that I'm going to host. It's in New Mexico. It's on Mr. John Eason's place. And it's a property that is in an area that, that produces some unbelievably big pronghorn antelope. And he only takes a very, very few of those bucks every year. And so this is going to be an opportunity to be on to get on that hunt. It's in the early part of October. And I'll be there. I'm going to be hunting as well, too, but I'll be hosting the hunt. And then we've got Trigicon's World of Sports Field. We're going to be filming that hunt for an episode coming up for next year, and that's one of the really fantastic hunts. And if you're into desert mule deer, let me tell you about a little hunt that's going to take place on the Apache Ranch that is going to be for a buck up to 170. Now, I'm sure they're going to stretch it right to that 170. The Apache Ranch is out in western Texas. It is the finest desert mule deer ranch in Texas. And that said, I can almost say it's the finest desert mule deer ranch in the world for the subspecies crookeye. Not only will somebody be able to take a 170 class mule deer, which is a really, really nice desert mule deer, and it will be a bow hunt. But I've been told by the managers and the people there that says if you can shoot a bow fairly accurately out to about 20, 25 yards, and if you can hit a target at 40 yards, there's a pretty good chance you're going to be able to take that buck. Now, part of that hunt, too, is going to be an audat hunt, and that's going to be a firearm hunt. It's one of those things you can take both animals yourself. You can hunt with a bow and take a mule deer, a really nice mule deer, and then switch over to a rifle and take an odd dad. Or if you've got a friend that maybe you want an odd dad and he likes to bow hunt, you know, that might be a really good combination. But you can learn more about those at dscf.org, and we'll start flashing some of those things on Facebook and a few other places and trying to make people aware of it. But again, if you're not a member of DSC, it is time for you to do so. We do so much. There are the organizations that like to take credit for some of the things that DSC does. That's really fine with us. The bottom line is we know who's getting it done and who's protecting hunter rights and who's protecting this and who's doing this and who's providing monies for research for the animals and the habitats that we love. Learn a little bit more about the DSCF. You can contribute. You can contribute through the gala that's coming up June the 12th. I think it's going to be mid-September that DSC is going to offer a whole bunch of hunts up at auction. If you can get involved and get something really good. And I will remind you that these, particularly the DSCF and Dallas Safari Club, they are 501c, nonprofit organizations. So any dollars that you spend beyond what the stated value is, that's a tax deduction. So, you know, you might, if you're in that bracket, and I hope you are, that, you'll be wanting to spend maybe a little bit more than what they state on the value so that you can get that deduction. But let me know what you think. Holler at me on Instagram at Larry Wysoon Outdoors or Facebook at Larry Wysoon Outdoors. Let me know what you think about what we're doing and also some of the things that you would like to hear about. And if you've got an argument, I'm ready for an argument. I love, not really arguments. We're never going to argue, but we certainly will express our opinions to each other kind of thing. But that's something that kind of happens around the campfire. And I'm hoping that you will join me right here again next week around the DSC campfire.
DSC's Campfires with Larry Wysoon has also been brought to you by Texas Wildlife Association, working for tomorrow's wildlife today. Texas-raised hunting products, the Scent Gods, Kittatrek boots for the trails less traveled, Voigt, the finest in hunting gear, Pyramid Air for all things air gun, and Ripcord Rescue Travel Protection.
You'd think, with four of us spread out on a tiny island, that the task of tagging a whitetail would not be a big thing. But, as I've learned, no matter where I've been, whitetails can be damn tricky.
Pursuing wild game in wild places. Tune in to Hunt Stand Presents Saturdays at 8:30 p.m. Eastern. Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.
You want to succeed, you want to fish, you want to be one of the greatest.
Tune in to West Marine's Life on the Water, presented by Costa Custom Boats, every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV.